In this hour of the program, we'll be talking with Karen Landgren. She is head of Child Protection Services at UNICEF. And we'll be talking about children and conflict around the world and just what we can and should be doing to see that they are protected. It has been estimated that since 1990, some 2 million children have died in conflicts around the world, and 6 million have been permanently disabled or injured. And our guest says that there are likely many more who have scars that will be less visible, who have experienced rape and loss and other trauma. We will, as I say, talk about this subject here this morning in this part of the show and give people who are listening, as always, the opportunity to call with questions. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people are brief, just so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. She has worked for the United Nations since 1980 and has held a number of management positions, both with the UNHCR, that's the High Commissioner for Refugees, and also UNICEF. Since 1998, she's been UNICEF's Chief of Child Protection, directing the agency's strategy for protecting children from violence, from exploitation and abuse, which is one of UNICEF's top priorities. Before that, she was with the UNHCR for 18 years. In a number of capacities, she was Chief of Standards and Legal Advice. Between 1988 and 93, she headed three country offices in Bosnia-Herzegovina, in Eritrea, and in Singapore. She was educated in Britain. She has degrees in international relations and international law from the London School of Economics. She is a national of both Sweden and the United States. She grew up in Japan and Denmark. And as I say, she's here visiting the campus. She last night gave the 14th annual Daniel Sanders Peace and Social Justice Lecture. This is a lecture that's now been taking place every year for quite a few years, and it's named for Daniel Sanders, who was the dean of the School of Social Work here at the University of Illinois from 1986 until 1989. Questions, as I say, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. That's the local number. And then we do have that toll-free line. If it would be a long-distance call for you, use that. That's 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
These numbers are truly staggering that I mentioned. 2 million children killed, 6 million injured, many more affected in other ways. Really startling numbers. You feel that those are reliable to the extent that we can, no?
To the extent that we can. It's very difficult to get numbers on any aspect of child protection, defined as violence, exploitation, and abuse against children, no more so than in armed conflict. Who's going to be out there collecting data? People are busy doing other things, including fighting. One good development is there is more and more insistence at the political level, meaning by governments, on knowing what's going on. So there's an initiative now to ramp up monitoring and reporting on abuses of children's rights in armed conflict.
We know certainly that one of the things that has been true, I think, of conflict the last, I don't know how many years now, is that in increasing numbers, civilians, non-combatants, are the people who are injured. And so I guess we wouldn't be surprised that some of those would be children. Are there cases, in fact, though, that children in conflicts are sometimes deliberately targeted?
That's one of the tragic developments. A historian was telling me last night that he doesn't remember cases of children being used in armed conflict before the 1900s, and that may be true. Certainly, one of the developments we have to thank, ironically, for that is the development of light weapons, weapons that can be carried by a 12, 13, 14-year-old. Children are targeted a lot to be used as child soldiers, and that's one of the worst abuses of children in armed conflict. But we've also seen in Sierra Leone, for example, the targeting of children for amputation of limbs, amputation at the elbow or at the wrist, short sleeve or long sleeve, as it was called. And in the former Yugoslavia, for example, during that conflict, the use of extreme sexual violence against women, but also against boys and girls. And sadly, the use of sexual violence is becoming a hallmark of conflicts all over the world.
Mm-hmm. And that is employed as a form of terrorism, I suppose, really.
It is. It's employed as a weapon of war. Now, we have in international law, finally, a recognition that this use of rape and other sexual violence isn't just one of those tragic byproducts of war, but it is a strategy used in war. It's been recognized now as a war crime, as and as a form of genocide.
Mm-hmm. What do you suppose has happened? I don't know if this is a question that can be answered, that we have come to this point where in previous conflicts, civilians are always going to be injured. But in previous conflicts, I think that those of the parties to the conflicts would have said, we're at least going to try to minimize civilian casualties. That we have gotten from that point to this point where civilians are and children in particular are deliberately targeted as a tool of war.
I think one of the factors is, especially after the end of the Cold War, a lot of the conflicts we're seeing are civil conflicts within countries, where the aim is to move people off territory, to get them displaced, to force them to flee, and therefore those are the people you want to terrorize. You want to do things that will make sure they leave and never come back. So that's become a strategy to move people away.
What sort of international conventions are there that address children and specifically this subject that we're talking about here, children and conflict?
There are more and more, starting with the Convention on the Rights of the Child in 1989, we've seen a growing amount of international law that regulates what can be done. There is, of course, prior to that, international humanitarian law, the Red Cross Conventions, the Geneva Conventions, that say what can be done with civilian populations, including children. But since the Convention on the Rights of the Child, there has been a specific protocol on the use of children in armed conflict from 2000. There is an International Labor Organization Convention on the Worst Forms of Child Labor, which includes child soldiering as one of those worst forms. And more recently, there are the International Criminal Tribunals for Rwanda, for former Yugoslavia, and now the International Criminal Court, the Rome Statute of 1998, which also says the use of children in hostilities is a crime, is a war crime.
Mm-hmm. How many countries have signed on to the Convention on the Rights of the Child?
All except two. And those two are Somalia and the U.S. But it is the Human Rights Convention that has had both the fastest and the most uptake of any.
Hmm. And yet at the same time, it sounds as if if we have everybody except those two countries, we know that there are other places where there are conflicts that children are injured. So having a country having signed on to it does not necessarily mean that children are not exploited or hurt or targeted in those places that are party to the convention.
That's absolutely true. And in conflicts, one of the first thing that goes out the window is legislation and law enforcement. So one of the big questions for the UN is how do we help protect civilians in those situations when law is not functioning, when there's complete social upheaval? And I one of the things I said last night was that our the world's response to genocide tends to be food. I mean, a lot of food aid is brought in to conflicts, whether it's former Yugoslavia in the 1990s or Darfur in Western Sudan now. And I think the world does very well on that side of things. But even food is, of course, an important weapon in civil wars, and each side tries to starve the other. But even the food aid and the humanitarian workers that go in to monitor it aren't enough to stop these worst abuses taking place. And the question for many countries is, are they willing to put in soldiers? Are they willing to put in troops to stop these abuses?
Perhaps let me just introduce very quickly the guest for this hour of Focus for anyone who might have tuned in the last few minutes. We're talking with Karin Landgren. She is Chief of Child Protection for UNICEF. And we're talking about efforts the agency is involved in to try to protect children from violence, from exploitation and abuse. And we're not just talking about children in the way that they're abused in conflict. I know that your agency and you are interested in trafficking in children, in sexual exploitation of children, children employed in child labor, and so that there are a number of things. It is more broad than the subject of children and conflict in a very wide sort of sense. So It's possible we might touch on those, some of those things too. And if people who are listening have questions, you are welcome to call 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, to go back to take up the question that you just touched on a moment ago, that I suppose is the big question, and that is what can one do? What can the United Nations do? What can governments do?
One thing we can do is try to talk not only governments but also militias into respecting the rights of children more. And that sounds like an uphill battle, and it is. But there are examples of talking militias into releasing child soldiers. The argument that this is against human rights and don't these militias want to be known for their respect for human rights? I mean, it has a touch of desperation to it, talking to militias about these things. But it has also worked in some cases. You can still appeal to some sense of justice in these militias. And we also have examples of other governments telling military forces, look, it's really unprofessional to use children in your forces. The first step you should take is to get rid of these children. But there isn't any easy answer of, okay, here's the program we need to go in and implement, and then it'll be all right.
Mm-hmm. It really is a sad story, the story of child soldiers that you've touched on, and we're starting to hear about more and more. And as you say, that the perhaps one of the developments that's made that possible is the fact that light weaponry is easily available, and it's something that a 12-year-old could carry. But in a lot of these places, I think that what they have found is that children are, to put it in a sad way, are a real exploitable resource, that you can take a child, if you take him or possibly her away from their family and break that contact, then I would think it might be easier to have control over them than it might be with an adult if you take them out of the place where they live and away from their family, and you say to them, we are now your family, and this is what you're going to do. And maybe take them far enough away so that even if they wanted to go home, they couldn't or they wouldn't know how. That it's, as I say, it's a resource that if you were fighting a war, for a number of reasons, is appealing.
The most vulnerable children are those who've already been taken away. Mm-hmm. And we've seen this in the recruitment of child refugees. So they're being recruited not by their own countries, not by militias in their own countries, but by others who recognize the desperation there and are able to take advantage of it with promises that they'll have a better life, that they'll have an education, that they'll have security, or by kidnapping and abduction. For example, in northern Uganda, over 12,000 children have been abducted by the Lord's Resistance Army and used in the fighting there. I should clarify, though, that when we talk about child soldiers, the image is usually one of an adolescent with an oversized weapon. But in fact, child soldiers are defined as all children who perform some function for the military or militia. So it involves cooks, sentries, messengers, sexual slaves. Children are used to lay and find landmines. There's a range of functions there. And it's very important that we recognize that those are child soldiers as well, because when the time comes to demobilize and reintegrate, we don't want to see programs that work just for those who are carrying weapons. Programs need to be in place for all those others who were used and abused in conflict as well.
Mm-hmm. The big challenge here, I'm sure, when fights end and you do get the opportunity to demobilize, or they are demobilized, to take children who have been uprooted from their places and from their family and to reintegrate them, to the extent that that's even possible, how do you do that?
We need a long time to enumerate all the challenges that come up in that context. It's very important that the needs of children are recognized as being distinct from those of adults. But you can imagine that, first of all, children who've been used in fighting forces and their commanders will sometimes want to conceal what they've done and what they've been made to do. In some countries, for example, in Colombia, it is a crime to have been a child soldier. And there are, I believe, at least 6,000 child soldiers in Colombia now. So UNICEF has taken a position that these children are victims. It's really not useful to talk about whether they joined voluntarily or involuntarily in such a desperate context as war. So we regard them as victims. We think they should not be punished, but they should be rehabilitated. Then you have the practical problem of children who have spent years in brutal and traumatizing circumstances having to go back to families, communities, and schools. Families often don't want them back. They carry a stigma when they come back. That's true for boys, but it's even more true for girls, because everyone knows that girls who have been associated with the fighting forces have been sexually abused. And they carry a stigma that I think is true all over the world. Communities and families tend to reject them. Some of them are coming back with babies. And then what is left for them to do? One thing that is left for them is to go into the sex industry. So it's very difficult to not only prepare them, but to prepare families and communities to take them back and welcome them back. Going back to school is another problem. These are kids who have, at best, missed many years of school. You're not just going to put them back in a classroom and expect them to pick up. Plus, they may be many years older. Again, in many situations, special schools have been set up for child soldiers because that's the only way of addressing the problem. That's how difficult reintegration is.
Yeah. It hardly seems fair, given the fact that in many of these cases, these children don't have a choice about whether they participate. It hardly seems fair to criminalize being a child soldier. Is that, you mentioned Colombia, is that true other places as well?
Increasingly, the tendency is not to criminalize, but to protect. And in Sierra Leone, where a special court was set up after the conflict, children are protected. We do have the challenge there of protecting child witnesses, and that's difficult as well. We expect children to come and testify and help convict those who are responsible for the worst abuses, but then we have to try and protect them from retribution afterwards. That's another challenge.
We do have a caller, and we'll bring them into the conversation now. Others who are listening, of course, are also welcome. Let me just quickly give you the numbers, 333-9455. That's for here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Champaign County on line one. Hello.
Hi. Jen, a while back you were talking about how it's never been done since this century or something. There aren't a lot of examples, but of course in European history there's the Children's Crusade, so and some of those kids were sold into slavery, I guess, so they but that's just one little point, and that's 1212. But I think there are a lot of other things. I didn't hear you. I must have lapsed when you mentioned Colombia, because I was thinking of Colombia in that we have the situation where the entire communities are deemed enemies because they're in a territory that needs to be that they need to be dislocated from the point of view of the landowners or whomever, corporations. Colombia has, you know, third highest dislocated people in the world, behind Sudan and I'm forgetting who has number two. On a personal note, I sort of informally helped give refuge to a child soldier from Uganda, and didn't dwell on the horrible things that he could tell me about it. We acknowledged it and we talked about it. But what I was amazed at is how resilient this fellow was. I mean, the personal story is so amazing, to be taken at the age of, I think it was in 7 or 9. He was made to kill his best friend in the organization because the fellow had done some minor infraction, but was mainly to test and further kind of alienate and control him, because if once one can do that. But again, what I was really amazed at was how resilient people can be. So, I mean, it's so dispiriting to hear some of this stuff, but I think that it's good to have the kind of outtake, as it were, in helping people. But this fellow just basically arranged his own flight over here through some friends. And so anyway, I'm getting nostalgic here, I guess, but I'd like for you to address a couple of those points. And the idea that whole communities, I mean, it's easy to focus on these particular instances, but I think the U.S. needs to be more self-reflective, as odd as an idea that is, about what its own role in this hemisphere has been. Thank you.
Okay. Well,
thanks. I think you've touched on a very important issue, which is the changing nature of war, and especially civil wars that have gone on for some time. You see shifting from, they probably started with an ideological intent, but then it often becomes a matter of control of resources. And that involves shifting people off and getting more resources and becoming criminalized. And it turns into something completely different. It turns into more gang violence, or for example, control of the drug industry because they need to finance their war, or control of the diamond industry. I mean, a few years ago, there was an initiative around, I'm forgetting the name now, dirty diamonds or black diamonds from West Africa, because that was powering the civil wars taking place in West Africa. And I think the last time I looked at statistics on Colombia, there were something like 1.5 million people displaced within the country. And that's before you look at others who've taken refuge outside its borders. Thank goodness children are as resilient as they can be. We can't count on it, though. In one interesting recent case, which is not a conflict but a useful example, is after the tsunami in Southeast Asia, when hundreds of thousands of people died and hundreds of thousands more were affected in some ways, and so many of these families and children were displaced, separated from their families, UNICEF has actually been in a position of saying, we don't necessarily need trauma specialists in the first few weeks and months, because in that period, the best thing we can do is try and normalize the surroundings of the child, put them in situations where they feel safer, where they can play, where they can draw, where they get food, where they're looked after, and then try and get them back in school. And after, say, 3 months, 4 months, then reevaluate who really still needs individual intervention. For one thing, if you have 100,000 children affected by tsunami, it's completely unrealistic to try and do trauma counseling with that many children. For another, it's normal that everyone is traumatized to a degree after that. So we're trying to hold off a bit on individual attention, counting on a degree of resilience to kick in.
All right, well, let's talk with another caller here. We have someone in Chicago on our line 4. Hello.
Hello, good morning. I have a question mainly about Afghanistan. There were reports earlier, I think maybe January, that there were horrible famines in the sort of isolated area. Well, practically all the countries isolated. I guess the road system's probably destroyed, and it wasn't much in the beginning. But in isolated areas, that people were coming out of these areas, and they had just a terrible famine because of the winter was quite bad. But I heard a professor, I think Alfred McCoy, say that the Russians and later the Taliban had pretty much destroyed the horticulture of the Afghani people, and that there was really no method of subsistence for them now, and they were mainly having to grow opium, which is one reason why the production has just skyrocketed. And I wanted to know if UNICEF has had been able to get any pulse of the degree of malnutrition, how much it's worsened throughout this entire, sometimes I guess it seems like there's just been one continuous war, I guess, since the late 70s. So do you have any feel for that or any idea?
One thing I can say is that Afghanistan used to be famous for its irrigation system, which was age-old and fed a breadbasket in the country. And that irrigation system has been destroyed by the war. Now, this isn't my field of expertise, and I don't know what it will take to bring it back. But certainly that's a catastrophic loss in terms of feeding the country. I know there is concern about malnutrition. I don't know more about it than that. And that the UN Office on Drugs and Crime has raised serious concerns about an increase in the level of opium production in the country. Now, one thing we see, again, not only in Afghanistan, is this nexus between drug production, drug dealing, and the financing of militias or terrorist groups. And that's certainly been the case in Afghanistan as well.
Well, my understanding in Afghanistan is that the drug is funding all groups, I mean, from the warlords who are in Karzai's government to the Taliban. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure if I think when you get to the level that the production is in Afghanistan, everyone has to be involved or it couldn't be such a high level of production. My other question is just, there was a Filipino activist, Tony Maloto, who was on Chicago Public Radio, and he made a very interesting point. He said that men in often crisis situations turn very predatory, and he suggested that when aid groups focus on women and children, it's almost to the effect of fattening up the chickens for the chicken hawk. Have you, in your work at UNICEF, is that ever a concern that when you do a program and you're focusing on the needs of children, that by not focusing perhaps on the male protector in the home or the male in the home, that there's a tendency for these people to become even more predatory, and in fact you're making the victim more more attractive?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think this is one of the lessons that's been learned. Learned at least in theory, and unfortunately still not always put into practice. And that is that in all our efforts to try and protect women and children better, we can't do it just working with women and children. I was involved in supporting a program for rights awareness training for women refugees in Kenya, and it was learned very quickly that women would take on board the idea that they had these rights, and they'd go home and talk about it and get beaten up. So these things can't be done without male participation. Another change we're seeing, though, is that so many of the logistics in refugee camps, to take one example, have either been regarded in the past as neutral technical issues like food distribution or camp structure or fuel or latrines. And in fact, they all have implications for protection. But the tradition was to bring in technical experts to set up these things. Now we know that we have to look at power issues in camp. To whom is food distributed? Well, often it's distributed to heads of family defined as men. It's usually in the hands of men. Where are the latrines placed? Are they placed far away from the camp for health reasons? Unlit with unlocked doors? Why then are latrines considered a particularly dangerous place for women and children? And when you put it all together, it's obvious. But for a long time, there just wasn't enough thinking about the power relations in a camp and the extent to which food, water, fuel, sanitation issues actually contributed to making women and children more vulnerable. There's also the reality that in many societies with displacement, women in the new situation are still playing their traditional roles of cooking and looking after children. It's the men who are more deprived of their usual jobs and functions. And I think this contributes to the fact that domestic violence increases tremendously in situations of displacement. And that's something I think we are still not very good at preventing.
That's a very interesting point. I just want to thank you for your work. God bless you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for the call.
Bye-bye.
We're here at our midpoint, a little bit past, actually. And I should introduce again our guest, Karen Landgren. She has worked for the United Nations since 1980 and has held senior management positions in the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, and also with UNICEF. And since 1998, she's been UNICEF's Chief of Child Protection. She is here on campus visiting, and last night gave a talk that was the 14th annual Daniel S. Sanders Peace and Social Justice Lecture. It's a series that's been going on now for a number of years on the campus, and it's named for Dan Sanders, who was dean of the School of Social Work here at the U of I from 86 to 1989. And we're talking about the subject of children in conflict and how they can be protected, something that is a major focus for UNICEF. Questions are welcome. We have someone here standing by. We'll get right to them. If you are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line, good to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. To another caller here, someone here on the campus, line number one.
Hello, am I on?
Yes.
I switched on late, so I don't know if somebody has already asked this question. I'm looking at what's happening here at home in terms of recruitment of people to serve in the armed forces. From what I read recently, incentives, monetary incentives, are being offered to 14-year-olds. To recruit them as soldiers. True, they won't serve until they're 18 and they're being compensated. But how close to making a moral decision about recruiting somebody who is underage are we as the richest society and presumably also the most, one of the most civilized societies. Has this question been investigated ever from a moral point of view or ethical point of view? I'm really concerned about that happening right here, although we tend to look at this child soldier phenomenon as something that's happening way out there in Africa or elsewhere. How close are we to that here at home? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you. I think it sounds like a very slippery slope. It's just recently, it's just in 2000, that in international law, the minimum age for compulsory recruitment was raised from 15 to 18. Now, UNICEF and other organizations have argued for what is called a straight 18 ban, which is no recruitment at all under 18, and that's what we would still advocate. At the moment, no one under 18 is allowed to take part in hostilities. States have to establish a minimum age for voluntary recruitment, and I think that's where a number of governments see a loophole. The law doesn't say what that minimum age has to be. We want it to be 18, but that's an open question. Now, normally, there are laws, there are minimum age laws for employment that should prevent 14-year-olds going into the armed forces. And I don't know the case you describe, but we would like to see no one under 18 recruited to serve in the military.
All right. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about was whether, in fact, the kind of training that peacekeepers get has now any particular emphasis on this particular issue, children's rights and protection.
This is one of the thorniest issues at the moment. And as some of your listeners will know, there have been huge scandals recently about peacekeepers themselves using children for sex in the mm-hmm. places where they're posted. And stories have come in from the whole world, from West Africa, from Haiti, from former Yugoslavia, from East Timor, of peacekeepers having sex with children. Now, these stories are not new. In Cambodia in 1994, with the UN operation there, there were stories about peacekeepers exploiting the local population. And the head of the UN operation there at the time, I'm sorry to say, responded publicly by saying, boys will be boys. And unfortunately, this didn't generate the indignation that it should have. And now, finally, it does. I think people have seen that if you put a bunch of soldiers, perhaps inadequately trained and briefed soldiers in a situation where they have the power, they have the money, and no one is telling them they're not allowed to have sex with children. That's going to happen. So finally, this is being taken very seriously. And last year, the UN issued guidelines on this, not specifically for peacekeepers, but for all humanitarian workers. I mean, these are the people who are supposed to be providing safety to children and others. And for them to turn around and abuse children is just a blot on the entire United Nations. Now there is an initiative specifically for peacekeepers, because until now it's been possible for peacekeepers who've abused children, and I'm sure they are in a minority, but it's been possible for them just to be sent home or to resign with no further action. And this is impunity, and that can't be allowed to happen. So the initiative now is to provide more peacekeeper training, to make sure there are court martials, or that these cases are dealt with either in the country they're posted or when they return home, and that the message comes out from all sides that this is not acceptable and it's going to be investigated. And increasingly, we feel that peacekeepers that are well-trained at home are less likely to commit these abuses when they go abroad. So that's one thing we want to focus on.
The role of the peacekeeper, I'm sure, is so difficult and so complex, and there are so many things that are asked of them, that apart from this particular issue about just in a sort of a general way what their behavior is, that simply doing the job has so many difficulties. And I would think that in one sense, if you add being a child welfare advocate onto all of the other things that they're called upon to do, it's difficult. And it may be, in fact, more difficult than some of the other things that they have to do.
It's a huge challenge. The UN has difficulty getting enough peacekeeping troops. That's a given. And in former Yugoslavia, for example, I think the UN was looking for something like 34,000 troops to secure safe areas. It got about 7,000. In Darfur now, there are 10,000 humanitarians working, 1,000 of them international, 9,000 Sudanese. There are only about 2,000 troops from the African Union, although more are expected. A call went out a year ago for more troops. That's the first challenge to be overcome, to get the troops. Second, when these troops go in, you have to remember they're all from other countries. So you have Bangladeshi troops going into former Yugoslavia. You have Ukrainian troops. You have Jordanian troops. They can't even always communicate among each other, let alone communicate with the local population. And I was just talking to someone who came back from Darfur recently, talking about the difficulty of preventing abuses against the population in Darfur and hoping that more African Union troops will come. On the other hand, what does a soldier from Burundi do set down in Darfur and confronted with a woman who fears the worst? There's such a gap between what they are trained for, which is fighting, and, as you say, some of the things we're counting on them to do.
We are moving into our last 15 minutes. Again, quickly, let me introduce our guest. We're talking with Karin Landgren. She is Chief of Child Protection for UNICEF, and talking about children in conflict. That's a subject that she spoke on in a talk she gave last night on the U of I campus and was good enough to come spend some time with us. Questions, again, are welcome. People who are interested in being involved in the conversation, you still may, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You talked a little bit earlier about the difficulties involved in reintegrating children after a conflict, because in many cases they are... they've been taken away from their homes and their families. Their lives have been disrupted in many ways. Touching on one is what's happening with their education. And also, as you mentioned, there may indeed be cases where their families would say that they don't want them back, depending on what kind of experiences that they have had. Having said all that, do you think that, in fact, children can have a special role to play in rebuilding after conflicts and in peacemaking after conflicts?
Not only do I think they can, I think it's essential, because these are the children, and especially the child soldiers, who are very easy to re-recruit. And in the first few years after the end of the conflict, the risks are so high that something will recrudesce, that it's the children we have to pay particular attention to. On the positive side, though, warring factions tend to find it easier to come to agreement over children's issues than they might on other political issues, which are extremely sensitive. Mm-hmm. At least at some level, we all have a soft spot for children. We want to protect our children, even if we don't always do it very well. So we've also found that a kind of humanitarian space can be created around discussions relating to children. So, for instance, if we look at peace agreements post-conflict, we can start by talking about the importance of amnesties for children, much easier than discussing if you're going to have amnesties for other people who were involved in the war. If I can go on to mm-hmm. another issue, the whole question of justice and reconciliation after a war is a profoundly interesting one. And in the last decade in particular, so many mechanisms have been set up and attempted to try to get away from this impunity that I refer to, which has often attached to people who commit atrocities in conflict. And there needs to be a balance between justice mechanisms and some sort of reconciliation or forgiveness mechanisms. There are a lot of things that have been tried, starting with, for example, the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which in a way traded truth-telling for punishment. And that was a bargain that was struck. More and more, we're seeing some hybrids that combine punishment for the instigators with a community-based process for the rank and file, including child soldiers. In Rwanda, for example, you have the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, which tries to get at the top people, the big fish, and a community-based system which brings all the others into the community where they are expected to confess and then very often are given amnesties for having confessed. There was a very interesting article in the New York Times 2 days ago titled Victims of Uganda Atrocities Choose a Path of Forgiveness, which is also an attempt to go through some traditional healing or reconciliation process where guilt is admitted, but the perpetrators are brought back into the community. Because especially where children are concerned, you don't want to lock them away. That's not the answer.
Okay. I think your phone is going off.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Jill will take care of that. And I'll just take this opportunity again to tell people who are listening who they're listening to. Our guest is Karen Landgren. She's Chief of Child Protection for UNICEF and visiting the campus here. And we're certainly open to questions. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think just maybe perhaps for our last 10 minutes or so to talk a little bit more generally about the United Nations. Within the last couple of years, I think that a lot of people at the UN have been thinking about the organization and its structure and its purpose, and that the Secretary General, Kofi Annan, has set in motion a process of reviewing the structure and the organization of the UN, asking questions about should there be certain sorts of changes. And then, of course, there are the goals that were agreed to, I guess, some time back about what the United Nations should be involved in terms of development. And it seems to me, at least, that indeed there are a lot of people who think that a major focus of the organization should be in development, in education, in doing things that will improve the lives of people around the world, which is a tall order and will require a serious commitment by member nations, and it will require money. And I guess I wonder, as you think about that particularly and that this kind of focus, how you think about that trying to meet as an organization, how you think about trying to meet that challenge and that very large need. Because mm-hmm. indeed, I think that Secretary General and other people have drawn a very clear line and a connection between peace and the well-being of people around the world. And if you want the one, that you're going to have the other.
Mm-hmm. Well, the whole purpose of the UN is to improve the lives of people, and we shouldn't lose sight of that. But the UN itself has different parts to it, and there is the political UN, which is the member states getting together in the General Assembly, in the Security Council, in other mechanisms to examine situations, adopt resolutions, and try to avoid, as the UN Charter says, the scourge of war for succeeding generations. And that is one whole part of what the UN does. Then you have the UN agencies and other mechanisms that are out there in the field trying to promote development, deliver humanitarian relief, help refugees, further the development of human rights, develop international instruments, and so on. And sometimes these two coexist rather uneasily. When I was working in former Yugoslavia, for example, trying to support the distribution of humanitarian relief, at the same time the UN in New York, the political part of the UN, was condemning the parties in former Yugoslavia, calling for airstrikes and so on, calling for criminal prosecution. And it was very hard to then try as a worker on the ground to say, look, we're here to help you, we're here to deliver humanitarian relief. So there is the political and the development and the human rights sides. I don't think, though, that we can draw a clean divide between development, politics, and human rights. One of the notions I've tried to promote more since I came to work in UNICEF is that what we tend to think of as human rights issues like violence, exploitation, abuse have a profound impact on development. For example, UNICEF tries to get all children in school. And we now recognize that it is impossible to get all children into school and help them learn when they're there unless we also address the question of violence. So many girls don't go to school or leave school, are intimidated while they're there because of the risks of violence and aggression and sexual exploitation from other students, from teachers, or on the way to school. So we're saying, look, this doesn't divide up cleanly into development on the one side and human rights off on some other planets. These are the same children who have development and human rights needs. They come together in the same issues. And we need to see this in a more holistic way.
Mm-hmm. You make me think of something else, and from time to time, I guess, when we've talked about the United Nations on the program, I sort of feel compelled to remind people that, you know, over the years, there has been controversy involving the United Nations and its activities in various points. People want to criticize the UN for either what it does or what it doesn't do. And I guess the thing that I feel it pains to remind people of, particularly when they make those sorts of criticisms, is that the United Nations is only as strong as the commitment of its member states. The United Nations really is this collection of countries, and it's not something separate from it. So you really, I think, have to look at the commitment that member states, particularly those who have resources like the United States, say. If you think that the United Nations is not doing what it should be doing, then you have to ask the question: well, what sort of commitment has been made by the wealthier nations, particularly, to put their resources behind the mission of the United Nations?
If you go to the UN website, un.org, you'll see the first words that come up are the United Nations, it's your world. And that's absolutely right. We need the commitment of member states to make the UN do what it should do. And it always feels rather ironic to me when governments step back and say, UN, you're not doing this, that, or the other. Well, it's your organization. We will do what you encourage us to do. And it's governments that have brought the UN this far in, for example, developing this great international law. We need governments to come back and help enforce it as well. And not only through the UN, it's governments in their dealings with each other that need to be upholding these standards as well. And in their own practice, it's no good to support a great international law and then go off and do something else in your own practice. And in the same vein, we count on governments to say, United Nations, this isn't working, or look at your own corporate governance. Look, there's a scandal here. Great, help us solve it, but please don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Like any corporate governance issues, they can be dealt with and better mechanisms can be put in place. We need government support for that.
Mm. Well, just as a way of finishing up, and there's really not very much time, but I guess I am wondering what you think, how well we are doing towards the fulfillment of the Millennium Development Goals, which were excuse me, the states, I think the members agreed, I believe it was in 2000, that's why they called them that. And the target, we're actually coming pretty close to the target date.
There's going to be a review of the Millennium Development Goals in September this year at the UN, and Professor Jeff Sachs, among others, are involved in that review. This will be the five-year mark of the MDGs. There are eight Millennium Development Goals. They are fairly traditional development goals, as the name implies. My concern is that they don't reflect human rights to a great extent. But so far, it doesn't look as if the world's doing very well on issues like maternal mortality, on girls' education in particular. I'm afraid that we will find in September that we are falling woefully short of where we hoped to be at the five-year mark. But the suggestion that is coming out now is that it is possible, if governments band together, to eradicate poverty by 2010. And I hope those suggestions will be looked at.
Well, we will have to leave it there. With our thanks to our guest, Karin Landgren. She is Chief of Child Protection at UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.